New World Notes, hosted by yours truly, Kenneth Doust. Today, we'll hear the second half of a nice talk journalist Chris Hedges gave in Seattle on June 29. Last week, Hedges recapped the century-long process by which corporate capitalism effectively abolished democracy in the U.S., and by which corporations, which by now are unrestrained, are plundering the society hand over fist. This week, Hedges starts with the Obama administration's assault on civil liberties. Hedges says the power elite finds this necessary because the people have had it up to here with corporate plunder and are starting to push back. Hedges ends today on a bit of a positive note. He talks about times when nonviolent citizen resistance effectively brought down oppressive and corrupt systems. There was the Russian Revolution, which originally was nonviolent. Then, from his experience, he tells how citizen resistance brought down the communist regimes in East Germany and in Czechoslovakia. These stories are really heartwarming, especially the parts about Czechoslovakia. Hedges forgets to name the country at first, but when he starts talking about Dubček and Václav Havel, that's Czechoslovakia. The Czechs' Prague Spring of 1968 was put down by the Soviets, but its memory was much alive when the Czech people sent their communist regime packing in the nonviolent Velvet Revolution of 1989. Don't miss this part. Sometimes populist movements like this succeed and do good, and sometimes they're co-opted and manipulated by right-wing sleazeballs. This happened in Germany after World War I, in Yugoslavia in the 1990s, and with the Tea Party today. So let's not get overconfident, says Hedges. But in contrast with the Tea Party, the Occupy movement is inspiring. And the government's coordinated and ham-handed repression of Occupy shows that the corporate elite knows that this is a force of some power. Here's Chris Hedges.
One of the things that has frightened me most about the Obama administration is its egregious assault against civil liberties, which are actually worse than the Bush administration. And that's because the corporate state, you know, if we have to date the final act of the corporate coup d'etat, it's probably 2010 with Citizens United. The corporate state is fully aware of what is happening. And they are rapidly criminalizing dissent, as Rahm Emanuel did in Chicago, because they know that as they harvest the country, it's a business term where you take over a business, you know it's not going to last, and you just squeeze it for short-term profit, that eventually there will be a backlash. So that's why Obama has not restored habeas corpus. That's why he supported the FISA Amendment Act, which retroactively makes legal what under our Constitution has traditionally been illegal, the warrantless wiretapping and monitoring and eavesdropping of tens of millions of Americans. And now we all know where your information is stored in supercomputers in Utah. That has permitted him to radically, I think, misinterpret the 2001 Authorization to Use Military Force Act to call for the assassination or carry out the assassination of American citizens, and then 2 weeks later, their 16-year-old son. And that's what has caused Obama to use the Espionage Act 6 times against whistleblowers, including Sterling, who purportedly gave information about war crimes to the New York Times. The Espionage Act was never designed to silence whistleblowers. In between 1917, when it was passed, and the Obama administration, it was only used 3 times against whistleblowers, the first being Daniel Ellsberg. And I have many friends who are investigative journalists, and they all will tell you that essentially no one within the structures of power will speak to them anymore, because Obama has essentially delivered the message that if you talk, you're probably going to go to prison. And this also, of course, is what led Obama to pass or sign into law on New Year's Eve the National Defense Authorization Act, which included Section 1021, which, until I sued him and we won in federal court, was law. But read it. It's terrifying. It authorizes or gives the government the power to use the military to seize American citizens on American soil, hold them in military facilities, including our offshore penal colonies, strip them of due process, and it's not just terrorists. It's citizens who have relationships with what they call, quote-unquote, associated forces, whatever that is, to hold them in these military facilities until, in the language of that section of the bill, the end of hostilities, which, of course, is indefinite. It's forever. And Dianne Feinstein, to her credit, when she read it, attempted to insert language into that section to exempt American citizens, and both the Obama White House and the Democratic Party rejected it. Fortunately, we had a courageous judge in the Southern District Court of New York, Catherine Forrest, who threw it out and issued a temporary injunction which essentially invalidates that section of the act, and we're waiting now to see whether the government will challenge it, and it'll move to an appellate court. The book was always called Days of Destruction, Days of Revolt. But when we began it, the revolt was conjecture. We certainly understood that with all restraints lifted on corporations, there would eventually be a response. But we didn't know what the response would look like. We didn't know when it would come. We didn't know where it would come from. And then September 17th happened in Zuccotti Park. And it made palpable what over the last 2 years had been posited, but something we couldn't show. And so I've spent a lot of time in Zuccotti. We went to Zuccotti, and the last chapter of the book is the Occupy movement. The only hope that we have now of challenging these corporate forces is by rebuilding mass movements. It is not going to come by placing a naive faith within the Democratic Party, Barack Obama, or the judicial system. That corporate coup is over. And for me, that's why Occupy was so important. It articulated the fundamental problem, which is that corporate power has seized control of our economy, control of our political system, and control of our systems of information, not to mention our systems of education. And it's only by building a mass movement that we have any hope of bringing them down. It appears quixotic, and yet I covered the revolutions in Eastern Europe, including East Germany, which was the most efficient police state, certainly in Eastern Europe, perhaps in the world, the Stasi state. For every 63 East Germans, there was a police informant. And what happened, and it's one of the reasons that I've been so critical of the Black Bloc anarchists, what happened is that you saw these courageous and lonely dissidents in Leipzig, mostly coming out of Lutheran churches, carrying out candlelit vigils against the regime of Erich Honecker, who had been in power for 19 years. And then suddenly a few hundred people joined them, and then a few thousand, and then East Berlin saw that there were 70,000 people marching through the streets of Leipzig. And they sent down an elite paratroop division to shoot the crowd. And when the officers went into the barracks to get the paratroopers, many of them were weeping because they had family and friends on the streets. Honecker sent that paratroop division down to Leipzig, and it never shot the demonstrators. At that point, he did not last another week in power. When you can pull those kinds of numbers into the streets, including 500,000 people in Alexanderplatz and East Berlin, who are nonviolent, who speak a fundamental truth about the corruption of power, what you do is you paralyze the forces that the ruling elite relies on for control. You draw those forces to you. And this is true in most revolutions. I mean, the Russian Revolution was in fact a nonviolent revolution. The violence came afterwards when Western powers backed the White Army that led to the Civil War, and Lenin and the Bolsheviks carried out a push to overthrow the Constitutional Assembly and Kerensky. But the revolution itself was nonviolent. And what led to the abdication of the Tsar were the Petrograd bread riots. And they sent the Cossacks in to quell the disturbances, and instead of quelling the disturbances, the Cossacks fraternized and joined the crowd. And the Tsar had to resign on a train carriage. He never even made it back. He had to resign on a train carriage before he could make it back from the front. I covered the revolution, or the Velvet Revolution. I spent every night in the Magic Lantern Theater with Václav Havel and Klaus and Dinsbier, all the people who would inherit the government. And Havel was, for me, an extremely important figure. Started Charter 77, virtually unknown. I mean, he was a kind of non-person within his country. His plays were never performed, in and out of prison. He has a wonderful 1978 essay called The Power of the Powerless. And his argument is that our greatest strength, when we articulate a truth, what he calls living in truth, is, there's a kind of incongruity to it, is our powerlessness, and of course our transparency. And during that revolution, it was driven home to me the importance of all of the acts of resistance that at the time were written off as impractical or futile. On every street in Prague, there were posters of a young Charles University student named Jan Panich, who, after the Soviet tanks had invaded Prague to overthrow Dubček and restore the pro-communist regime, had gone to Wenceslas Square and lit himself on fire. 4 days later, he died of his burns. Thousands of students marched with his body to the cemetery. They were broken up by the police. His act was never mentioned on state media. When his grave became a shrine, the communist authority exhumed his body, cremated it, and gave the ashes to his mother and forbade her from reburying them. And yet his picture was everywhere. 2 weeks after the communist government fell, 10,000 people gathered in Red Army Square in the center of Prague and renamed it Jan Panich Square. I was with those crowds, 500,000 people, on that December night when one of Czechoslovakia's most famous singers, Marta Kubashaya, walked out on a balcony before the crowd. She had sung the anthem of defiance that was broadcast over the airwaves to inspire resistance. When the pro-Soviet communists regained control, her entire recording stock was destroyed. She was never allowed to appear on the airwaves, and she existed by working as on an assembly line in a toy factory. And yet when she walked out that night and began to sing that anthem, everyone in that crowd knew every word. The Occupy movement has been knocked off balance consciously, but finally it is always the ruling elite that determines the nature of resistance. When there was that central decision to destroy those Occupy encampments, for me it was an extremely telling moment, because it showed that the only thing the centers of power, corporate centers of power, had to offer was repression, force, and violence. And many of you, I'm sure, read Krugman, who keeps calling for a rational economic policy. And he and I were both on Democracy Now! A few weeks ago. I spoke, and then Paul was on. And afterwards, I said, Paul, everything you write is true, but it's only possible if you have systems of power that are rational. Once systems of power essentially retreat, as our elites have done, into their version of Versailles or the Forbidden City. I think a writer from New York, The New Yorker, called it Richistan. Once they are totally out of touch. Once they start cannibalizing themselves, I mean, there's a really great book, which I just reread, by Crane Brinton, called The Anatomy of Revolution. He studies several revolutions, including the American Revolution, the French Revolution, and he lists sort of the fundamental prerequisites for revolution, all of which we have fulfilled. A corrupt elite, a disempowered, a working class that keeps getting pushed further and further into misery. But at the end of that list, he says, the most important thing about revolutionary movements is that their fundamental demand can never be met by the ruling class because it would mean their dissolution. And one of the critiques of the Occupy movement from, you know, all the courtiers on the airwaves was, what are their demands? They don't have any demands. Well, they had a very clear demand, and that is, we want to reverse the corporate coup d'etat and take back for the citizenry the power that has been wrested from our hands by corporations. But that was, of course, a message that Wall Street and its minions could never hear. The decision by the state to respond with force, for me, instead of responding rationally, which would have been a national effort, a national jobs program, massive jobs program, especially targeted at people under the age of 25, a moratorium on foreclosures and bank repossessions, a forgiveness of all student debt, the public option for all, that would have broken the movement in the way that the New Deal legislation broke the radicalism with the breakdown of capitalism and, as Conrad Black pointed out, saved capitalism. And so we've entered a new era, and there will be a reaction. I don't know what it will look like. Even the purported leaders, or those closest to the movement, don't know what it will look like. On November 9th, 1989, I was with all of the leaders of the East German opposition in Leipzig, and they said, maybe within a year, there will be free passage back and forth across the Berlin Wall. Within a few hours, the Berlin Wall, at least as an impediment to human traffic, did not exist. We have a moral imperative, especially for those of us in this room who have children, because we've betrayed them, to stand up and fight for life. In theological terms, and anyone who reads climate science reports, I think, cannot dispute this, corporate forces are systems of death. They are willing to sacrifice us all. It's not a particularly new phenomena in civilizations. It happened on Easter Island. It happened to the Mayans. But this time, if we go down, the whole planet goes down with us. I did a action a couple weeks ago in Zuccotti Park with Father Daniel Berrigan, who's 92. And as Berrigan says, we're called to do the good, or at least the good insofar as we can determine it, and then we have to let it go. Faith is the belief that it goes somewhere, that the good draws the good, even if all of the empirical evidence around us show otherwise. The Buddhists call it karma. But I think that we've got to stop asking the question, is it practical? And start asking the question, is it right? And I believe that the inner workings of corporate power are so corrupt and so fragile that with the kinds of mass movements that I saw in Eastern Europe, they can be defeated. Thank you.
What do you think is the one unifying principle that we could all unite behind to create a mass movement here in America?
all of the tinders there for the mass movement. I mean, you know, I covered the two Palestinian uprisings or intifadas, the revolutions in Eastern Europe, the street demonstrations that brought down Milosevic. They all have a kind of unifying quality, which is that you know the tinder is there, but you never know what it is that will ignite it. None of us can know, but it is there. And we've just seen in the last few weeks the government deny hundreds of thousands of Americans the extension of their unemployment benefits, the Supreme Court decision that was an assault against public sector unions. I mean, it is just the refusal to fund adequately food stamps, and 6 million people in this country, their sole source of income is now food stamps. One in every three children eat in this country because of food stamps. When Clinton destroyed welfare, what, you know, sort of wasn't gotten out was that 70% of the recipients of welfare support were children. So corporations know only one word, and that's more. And they will push and push and push until there is a backlash. It can go the wrong way, as it did in the 1930s. And we have powerful, essentially proto-fascist movements that speak in the language of violence, that celebrate the gun culture, that direct a legitimate rage and betrayal towards the vulnerable, Muslims, undocumented workers, homosexuals, intellectuals, feminists. They got a very long list. And they are backed by the most retrograde forces in our society, including the Koch brothers and others. And that's why it's extremely vital that those of us who care about nonviolence, care about an open society, begin to make sacrifices which are not comfortable. Wendell Berry, 77 years old, occupies the governor's office in Kentucky to fight mountaintop removal. And before he goes in, he goes, to be honest, going to jail is more time than I care to donate to the U.S. government. But Cornel West, Bill McKibben, they've all come to the same conclusion that we've got to, you know, to throw a wrench in the machine, and we've got to do it with our bodies.
Yep. Thank you.
Do you believe that the recent ruling by the Supreme Court regarding corporations being human beings further entrenches and codifies totalitarianism?
Yeah, I think that that 2010 ruling was it, and you can see it because they now have the capacity to essentially destroy anyone who stands in the way of corporate power. I think the recall in Wisconsin is illustrative of the tragic mistake that we don't want to make. We allowed that energy. It could have gone either way. It could have gone towards general strikes, which is where they should have gone. But they funneled it back. They funneled it back into the dead political system, what Benjamin DeMott calls junk politics. The Democrats took control. Organized labor, which has not been very good, took control. They coughed up a retread Democratic candidate. And then, of course, you know, the Koch brothers and everybody came in and crushed it. And it's going to be very hard for them to rebuild what they had. It's not our job to take power. All of the correctives to American democracy came through movements that never achieved formal power. If you look at the political decline that we have undergone, you would have to sort of accept that the last liberal president that we had was Richard Nixon. Because he was still scared of movements. So we got OSHA, the Mine and Safety Act. There's a wonderful scene in Kissinger's memoirs, don't go buy the book, where there's a huge anti-war demonstration. I think it's 1971. Nixon's rung the White House end-to-end with buses to keep out the demonstrators. He's standing at the window with Kissinger, wringing his hands, going, Henry, Henry, they're going to break through the barricades and get us. And that's just where we want people in power to be.
I think that gentleman.
What's your thinking on like a coup d'etat within the next year in our country?
Any seismic change or revolutionary change requires a crisis. Now, unfortunately, because movements, populist movements have been destroyed, what is actually ascendant and backed is right-wing populism, which is very frightening. It resembles the Nazi Party in the sense that you have a right-wing populism that is backed, in the case of the Nazis, by German business interests, in the case of the Tea Party and others, by corporations. So the linchpin tends to be currency, a currency collapse. I've lived through three of them. And then the world order is turned upside down. This is what happened in Yugoslavia. The war in Yugoslavia was not caused by ancient ethnic hatreds. It was caused by the economic collapse of Yugoslavia. And when the currency collapses, the moral order is instantly inverted, because all of the people who are on fixed income, who'd put money aside every month, who were living on pensions, who had fixed wages, were destroyed because their currency wasn't worth anything. And it was all the gangsters and the speculators and the war criminals who were filthy rich. And the anger in Yugoslavia was manifested by supporting figures like Radovan Karadzic, who everyone knew was insane, just out of disgust. And we're not immune from that at all. I don't take the lunatic fringe of the Republican Party and these frightening, deformed figures on the far right, I don't take them lightly, because I watched those kinds of figures become ascendant in Yugoslavia. And it worries me. I mean, so there's no guarantee that we're going to exit this with sanity.
I was wondering how Ayn Rand really got her preeminent rise as the high priestess of the right in this country.
Well, that's a good point. I mean, look at who these people's intellectual foundations are. It's a third-rate economist like Milton Friedman and a third-rate novelist like Ayn Rand. It's insane. I mean, the idea that making an entire human society sacrifice itself before the dictates of the marketplace, there's nothing in 3,000 years of economic history to justify this absurdity. And yet, go to any economics department in this university and it's just a big vat of laced Kool-Aid. It's crazy. And you can't even get into the debate unless you buy this essentially utopian belief. And what we're watching, of course, is the breakdown of globalization. And yet all of those figures, including the popularizers of it, like Thomas Friedman, continue to speak in a language that is increasingly divorced from what's happening. All of the promises of globalization have turned out to be a lie. And I think part of the problem, unlike Europe, is that with the destruction of the left, of populist movements, we've been robbed of the language by which we can describe what's happening to us. And it's called class warfare.
Chris Hedges. His answers in the Q&A were as good as his speech was. I gently edited both for radio. Thanks again to Mike McCormick and Mind Over Matters for the full recording. And thank you for listening. NewWorldNotes.blogspot.com. Illegitimae non carborundum, de gustibus non est disputandum, pardon my Latin, and catch you later.